Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Notable.
Where's Jeff?
Okay. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Notable.
Yes, hello. Yeah, our last one before we go back on the road, Stuart.
We're going back on the
road. We are, yeah. I'm so excited. You'll be able to hear the excitement running right through this one, I think, in anticipation.
Next week's instalment, if you're doing this on a weekly basis, and I hope you are, maybe you're binging on them all in one go, but the next instalment of Notable, the podcast about quirky, fascinating music history, will be from the Timber Festival.
It will, yeah. We love the Timber Festival. It's in the new National Forest near Ashby de la Zouche,
yeah.
If you want to come and join us.
And yes, of course you could, because you could listen to this before we get there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Weekend of the 3rd and 4th of July, isn't it? Depending on when you're listening. We don't want people turning up in Ashby de la Zouche in August.
No, we don't want that.
Don't do that.
We don't want that, although the Ashby de la Zouche Tourist Board
might enjoy it.
They'll be happy if you do. No, but today we're going to talk about Wendy Carlos.
We are.
And Norman Pilcher.
Norman
Nobby Pilcher. More on him in a moment. Wendy Carlos.
Yeah, Wendy Carlos. So Jeff and I actually. Jeff, hi.
We're, Producer Jeff.
Yeah.
We're not with him today. He's letting us do this ourselves.
He's very brave.
Yeah.
Who knows what might happen. Yeah. So we were finding out a bit more about Wendy for Radio 4 recently. People might want to listen to our programme, Archive on 4, Woman Machine, still on BBC Sounds. But yeah, so she's a musician who really encouraged Robert Moog. Moog is the correct spelling, isn't it? We've already discussed
apparently it. It's Moog.
The Dutch.
But no one says that, do they?
Yeah, yeah. So she encouraged him to develop the Moog synthesizer and helped him engineer it as well. She released a really landmark classical album, Switched on Bach, as they get me to say on Radio 3, Moog synth versions of Bach compositions. So that obviously shook up the classical world, but it really changed the perception of the synthesizer as well. And it moved it from being not just a kind of sound effects instrument, but a proper instrument on which you could play classical music, proper music. So a bit more on that later. But she had an extraordinary life, really. She was born into a working class family in Rhode Island. She learned to play the piano because her father drew a keyboard on a piece of paper and she would sort of just put her fingers up across the drawn keys.
Really?
They couldn't afford a piano, yeah. So she had lessons, but then in between she practiced
what, and heard it
on
in
the
her
paper
head?
And could, yeah, exactly.
You're too young to remember this. There was a thing. There was a music quiz show on TV, someone should bring it back, called Face the Music. And for one bit of it, there was this dude called Joseph Cooper who used to sit at the dummy keyboard. I remember this from being a little kid. And I loved it, even though I knew nothing about classical music because I was about 8. But I used to love it. And he would sit down at the dummy keyboard. It was a keyboard that didn't play.
Okay.
And go... And people would go,
what is that?
And people would go, oh, that's Rachmaninoff's Third Piano Concerto. They would.
Really?
Can you imagine that? Can you imagine the BBC now doing a highbrow classical music quiz where people would go, oh, that's, I know that. That's Janáček's Second Piano Sonata.
What, so they just know from
You'd have to get it from just the fingering.
All right,
yeah.
Stuart, what's this?
That's Beethoven's Fifth.
Oh, my gosh, I'm really good at this.
Can you imagine that now? Anyway.
Just imagining the notes from that. Just watching the fingers. Oh, I see what you mean. They could actually see
No, but you could see,
fingers.
But you can. I mean, if you know a little bit about music and rhythm.
Yeah.
But this was like 8:30 on BBC Two. Oh, can you imagine that? No.
We could bring that back.
I think they should. If you're listening to BBC Two,
that could be our next podcast.
bring Face the Music back with me and Elizabeth. Come on.
So, Face the Music. So, yeah, Wendy Carlos, that's how she learned.
Wendy Carlos.
On this paper keyboard that her dad drew for her. She obviously showed real kind of aptitude for technical design and engineering from an early age. She built a hi-fi system for her parents and she won a science contest at the age of 14. She invented a kind of prototype computer. She's incredible. Wow. Then she made her first tape machine for music making. She was interested in that from a young age, something we I think we're obsessed with on this programme, Music Congrats.
Yeah.
It all comes back to that. And then I should say a lot about her life is kind of unknown because she lived as a recluse relatively, for at least a decade after her gender transition. So she was born Walter Carlos.
She was.
A lot of her early successes and releases are under that name. And then, of course, you know, we're talking in the 60s and 70s, so things were a lot different then. And it took her some time to kind of emerge publicly with this new identity, Wendy Carlos. And she was, which has been reasonably secretive about it ever since, really.
Right.
She's quite famously litigious.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If people write things about her, she can be, and she rarely gives interviews. Although, there is some absolutely fantastic... Again, on the BBC in 1989, this was. Hard to imagine it being broadcast now on mainstream TV. There's an interview with her. She's got kind of Siamese, I think it is, cat draped across her shoulders, and she's demonstrating on an old Moog synthesizer, which looks like a telephone kind of operator room from the wall. It's so complex, all these wires. I'd love to train Terry to kind of drape across my shoulders, then I could just
absolutely
swan
when
around.
We do the TV version. Yeah. When we do Face the Music on BBC Two with the dummy keyboard. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the 60s, she went to study music and physics at Brown and Columbia, and immediately after that, she found herself at a music technology and audio conference in New York, and that's where she first met Robert Moog.
Okay.
Apparently, he was asleep on a chaise longue. Wow. Do you remember that chaise shorts we found in the Six Music Festival?
Yeah, we did, yeah. So he was asleep on a chaise longue?
He was, yeah. And she knew who he was. She knew about his early kind of experiments with oscillators and that kind of thing. She had all kinds of ideas already as to how this, you know, new instrument that would become the synthesizer could be developed. His kind of early, you know, synthesizer models, how they could be developed. A lot of it was to do with the way the person operating it could kind of control the pitch and the timbre, like a real musician.
Yeah.
So she was really kind of instrumental in developing it in that way. She really helped him turn it into more of a kind of fully fledged instrument. And then she used it like one. So as I said, switched on Bach. We get this in 1968. Bach compositions performed on the Moog synthesizer. Apparently it took 5 months and 1,000 hours to record. But it's not just kind of note for note reinterpretations of the Bach. A lot of the musicality is kind of reframed, isn't it? It's very much Bach for synthesizer, but I think we get this, I suppose it's the synthesizer expressing, you know, the condition of the human soul, which is pretty novel for technology to do that. And that's why it was so revolutionary.
It is amazing, isn't it? I mean, for copyright reasons, as we all say, we can't play that music now, but when we're finished, go and listen to it. Because if you think that electronic music is cold and bleak, which some people do, because he has that, because I guess post-Kraftwerk, it kind of took that thing on.
And machine-generated
exactly,
as opposed to human interpretations.
Exactly. But it's not like that, is it?
It's not.
It's playful and,
Yeah, there's a lot of personality and character and humanity in it, I suppose. Also a lot of, as I say, kind of reinterpretation of the original Bach, but he allowed space for that. So for the second movement of Brandenburg Concerto No. 3 in G major, he only actually provided two chords and the rest could be improvised around. So she did a lot of kind of work with that piece in particular, reconstructed this piece to showcase the capabilities of the Moog. So yeah, just like I say, a testament to the timelessness of Bach, I think.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Because it does sound very contemporary, doesn't it? But also just the ability of the machine and, you know, endless possibilities of the machine to make music.
There is a certain machine-like quality to Bach, isn't there?
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons I quite like it. It's very crisp.
Mathematical.
It's very crisp and logical, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of numbers, work, maths, it was hugely successful, this record.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah, in 6 years, it sold over 1 million copies. Sheesh. Who'd have thought it? You know, the label didn't expect it to do that well, as you wouldn't. Only the second ever classical album at that time to go platinum. It won Grammy Awards for Best Classical Album, Best Performance, Best Engineered Classical Album. Of course, the Grammys have got a category called that. And it's also been hugely influential. Leonard Bernstein was a massive fan, actually. Mm. And he worked with Wendy Carlos to present an evening of electronic music at the Lincoln Center.
Right.
And, you know, people like Giorgio Moroder have said it was the thing that switched him on to electronic music. A big influence on Martin Hannett, actually.
Yes.
And he said that you can hear it in the kind of Manchester sound that he was playing a massive part in producing. Latterly, people like Will Gregory have said how important it was. And also, you know, he said, just in terms of people's perception of machines, of music technology. And also what we've said before about technology giving people means to make music who might not otherwise have had it. So it took Wendy Carlos from her like paper keyboard to being able to make music with Leonard Bernstein at the Lincoln Center rather than needing the money to commission orchestras herself or, you know, write with a kind of huge performing group in mind, which obviously she would not have had the means to do. So, yeah, massively influential in all kinds of ways. Carlos, she went on to release a number of other studio albums. The soundtrack for A Clockwork Orange.
Famously Clockwork Orange.
Also the score to The Shining as well. She composed the score to Disney's 1982 film Tron.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, that was like a mixture of her synthesizer music and then music from the London Philharmonic as well. And she also released a record, it's very influential, perhaps not as famous, Sonic Seasonings, which was, well, some say it's the first ever ambient album. Okay. It was kind of field recordings which take the listener through all seasons throughout the year. But it's kind of exploring those concepts of space and natural sounds being part of music, interacting with music, which, you know, are central to the ideas articulated by Brian Eno in his writings on ambient music. He wrote that, though.
Yeah. Do the Clockwork Orange soundtrack, does that use some of her Switched On Bach stuff?
I think it does. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So her gender transition was complete by 1972, and then she sort of slips away from the limelight. She once said she lost an entire decade. Right. There's even a story that Stevie Wonder, who is famous for using the synth in some of his biggest records, apparently he came looking for her for some kind of synth inspiration, and he was knocking on the door and she hid because she didn't want to kind of, you know, emerge with this new identity and it to be really public. She talks about her transgender identity with Playboy, of all publications, in 1979. And she kind of related it to the reaction to Switched On Bach when that was released. She said, those who were comfortable in all forms of music, those who were open to novel variations, loved it. She's talking about Switched On Bach here. And she says, transsexuality too is an emotional, action-prone situation in that it tends to polarise people depending on the attitudes one brings to sexuality and human rights. In both cases, there's no middle ground. So,
Wendy Carlos,
not a middle ground person by any means.
I also think it's fascinating that there is another, because Walter Carlos, as Wendy was then when she had the early hits, there's another interesting story, journey of gender transition with another Walter. There's a guy called Wally Stott, who I don't know if you've ever heard of.
No.
Walter Stott. Brilliant arranger of pop records in the 1960s. Scott Walker's arranger. Absolutely genius arranger, who is now Angela Morley. And I just think that's just a quirky coincidence. These two brilliant Walters both transitioned.
That is interesting.
And
she's 81 now, still alive. Possibly one of the most important, well, not possibly, definitely one of the most important living pioneers in electronic music.
Absolutely. It's such an influential record, that, and sort of leads us into our notable exception.
It does, yeah. We've got one.
Producer Jeff.
He won't believe it.
You won't believe it. We've actually thought one in advance because it's a sort of notable exception. The first Moogs bought to Britain were bought by George Harrison of the Beatles, using it on Abbey Road, and Mick Jagger.
Yeah.
But what's unusual and notable about Mick Jagger, Elizabeth?
So he bought a hugely expensive modular Moog in 1967, and he used it only once, and that was in the film Performance.
As a prop.
Yeah, as a prop. And then he sold it. This story does get better.
Sold it to Tangerine Dream.
Amazing.
That is amazing. So so I guess if you love, like I did, those early Tangerine Dream records, the Phaedra and Rubicon, these are. That's the synth they bought from Mick Jagger. Who, lazy old Mick, couldn't be bothered learning how to play it.
He just twiddled it around in performance
and flogged it.
One of many things he was twiddling around with in performance.
Well, I have no idea what Elizabeth means, so let's move on.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Let's move on to Norman Clement Pilcher.
Ooh.
Born 1936, transferred from the flying squad to the drug squad in 1967, and became, for a while, maybe Britain's most famous policeman, because he became the policeman who went after pop stars, didn't he?
Yeah. He did, yeah.
Now, I've been listening to a podcast with him on recently. He's passed away just recently, but I listened to a podcast, one of the last things he did, and he sort of tries to say, and indeed he does say it, like, 4% of my work, he says, was going after pop stars. But it's such that he did it so famously. And he says he went after, he says 8, but then he lists 7 people. And they are Levi Stubbs of the Four Tops.
Yeah.
Dusty Springfield.
Yeah.
Lionel Bart.
I know.
Tubby Hayes, the jazz saxophonist, of which more in a moment. But most famously, I guess, John Lennon, George Harrison and Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones.
Interesting playlist there of Noddy Pilcher's.
So, target. Tubby Hayes, let's start with Tubby Hayes because this is an interesting one. Hayes living in Chelsea, and I don't know where it comes from. So, did he have an abnormal interest in musicians, Norman Pilcher, or was it just his job? But in 68, they raid Tubby Hayes' flat and find traces of dimorphine and heroin. And apparently, and Pilcher says this about himself, he says that he helped him, he drove him to Charing Cross Hospital to get him some help for his heroin addiction, as well as kind of, you know, charging him with it as well. So then, to be slightly unfair, you might say, well, he gets a taste for it now, Pilcher, gets a taste for the high life.
Because he was always pictured, wasn't he? That's the thing.
He's always pictured. There's only one bit of actual moving footage, I think, of him when he arrested Brian Jones and you see him coming out. But, I mean, some people think, oh, he got a taste for it. He just liked becoming the guy who went after pop stars.
Was he really famous at the time?
I think he was. We'll come back to how his fame... We'll come back in a moment to exactly how famous he became, because he's been immortalised in different things, songs.
Yeah.
But we'll come back to that. Epstein's been dead a year. The Beatles haven't got that kind of carapace of protection around them. So he decides, Lennon and Ono, because Lennon's staying up with Ono, and they're sort of moving around London peripatetically, aren't they? They've not got a proper base. They're living in a succession of flats around London. And they're living in Ringo Starr's pied-a-terre in West London at 34 Montague Square. Starr's gone, but he keeps it on as a kind of pad for his mates. Jimi Hendrix lived there for a while. And there's a great picture, isn't there, of Jimi Hendrix like cooking up some bacon and eggs with Ringo Starr in the background. But Hendrix has got like a frock coat on. And
he's like velvet.
Exactly. He's like dressed to go on stage, but he's making Ringo Starr like bacon and eggs.
He was a big fan of Coronation Street as well.
Was he?
Yeah, Jimi Hendrix.
That's another notable.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Can you imagine if Hendrix had guested in Coronation Street, coming to the cabin for some lighter fuel to set fire to his guitar? So Pilcher and the drug squad hear that Lennon and Ono are living in this flat in Montague Square in West London and might be recreationally using some stuff. Lennon's sort of matey with the Daily Mirror reporter called Don Short, who sort of says to him, you want to watch out, you're on Norman Pilcher's radar sort of thing. And what happens, though, Lennon manages to, and he says, you know, there's going to be a raid. The first time, knowing that Jimi Hendrix has been there recently, Lennon personally vacuumed the flat to ensure nothing was there. And Pete Shotton, what Beatles entourage, he's there as well, removes the vacuum cleaner bag and disposes of it. But then, 11:55 a.m., just before noon, Friday the 18th of October, Lennon and Ono still asleep. Mm. Hey, you and I, we're up at 5:30 at the weekend.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But rock stars stay in bed till 12.
Yeah, this was the 60s, wasn't it?
And they hear a knock on the door, and it is, Lennon says, all of a sudden there was a knock on the door and a woman's voice outside. She said, I've got a message for you. We said, who is it? You're not the postman. And she said, no, it's very personal. And this woman starts pushing the door. We had been in bed and our lower regions were uncovered. Yoko ran into the bathroom to get dressed, and I said, ring the lawyer, quick. So, outside are 8 policemen, Lennon, he didn't notice. There's a Daily Express cameraman there as well.
Right.
Which is interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who told the Daily... Norman, how did you tell him? So anyway, Yoko gets in touch with Apple and they bring two sniffer dogs in, Boo Boo and Yogi. And...
Where are they now?
I don't know. Where are they now? Well, sadly, they'll be dead, won't they?
They still do. Yeah. Well,
come on. It's 1969. Come on. Aww. Unless they're the world's oldest dogs.
Still doing their, like...
Yeah.
Comedy
but
circuit.
They managed to find, despite Lennon's hoovering up, they managed to find 219 grains of cannabis resin. Now, these days, in the more, I mean, we're still pretty unrelaxed about drugs, aren't we? But yeah, I think you would be given, I think your PC would give you a clip right here and send you on your way. But they charged him with possession, Paddington Police Station at 1:20 p.m. And then Pilcher says, oh, while you're here, can you sign a couple of albums for me? Suggesting that he was enjoying his newfound role as a celebrity drug buster.
Well, didn't they actually write to each other, Lennon and Pilcher?
They did. Eventually. Hilariously, one of the albums he starts, he gets out, is Two Virgins. I mean, you'd think he would have, like...
Yeah, some of the big ones.
Revolver and Sgt. Pepper. But one of the ones he gives me to sign is Two Virgins. That's got to be an awkward moment when Pilcher says, sorry about dragging you here and arresting you. Could you sign these nude pictures of yourself for me? Anyway, Lennon always insisted he'd been framed. He said he'd hoovered up and it must have been planted. Fined £150. But that's not the main problem, really. The trouble is that going forward, it caused them all kinds of grief. It was part of his struggles to get American citizenship. He was deported in 71 from America because of it. And Ono said it contributed to her losing custody of her daughter, Kyoko.
Oh, really? So, right, OK.
So... But he goes on from strength to strength, if you want to put it that way. March 12th, 1969, ironically the night Paul McCartney married Linda Eastman,
okay.
He busts Harrison in his... I never know, is it Esha or Esha? I think it's Esha, isn't it? Is it?
Esha, yeah.
He said, this is hilarious. When Pilcher opened up an enormous stash of marijuana hidden in a shoe, Harrison said, I'm a tidy man. I keep my socks in the sock drawer and my stash in the stash box. That's not mine.
Was it a policeman's shoe?
Well, size 10, yeah. This sort of slightly dubious bust brings an end, really, to Pilcher's activities on musicians. He does Brian Jones as well, who apparently was terrified. But this sort of brings it off. This sort of brings it to an end. Weirdly, Pilcher gets convicted of perjury himself because of a drug case, which suggests all was not going exactly by the book, and he goes to prison.
I know, 4 years ago, didn't he?
Pilcher went to prison himself.
Was it like fabricating entries in the police diary the judge made an example of him, basically, didn't he?
For sure, because this was when they were clamping down on corrupt cops around Soho and London, wasn't it?
Yeah. Bank coppers.
Several celebrities said he'd framed them. Or they said that he only did these busts for the tabloids who were, encouraging him sort of thing.
Why did he decide? I mean, obviously, these are high profile, they were high profile cases. But why were they targeting pop stars at that time? Was it like a clean up society? Or
I don't know if it was as much that, but maybe just the press had thought, you know what, some of these... Because remember, we're talking like the early days of what you might call the counterculture.
Yeah.
So I guess these tabloid papers are going, hey, do you know what? Some of these pop stars... they're getting up to no good, and that would make for good copy, I guess.
I remember even being a small kid in the 80s and my grandma and granddad talking about how the Beatles took drugs.
Yeah.
People always talked about it at that time, didn't they, that older generation.
They talked about it, didn't they, openly? They talked about it, the Beatles. And I think there's definitely class and youth prejudice, isn't there? A lot of the establishment, I think, hated the fact that people like the Beatles and Mick Jagger are the new aristocrats.
Yeah.
Because they thought that it should be people like them. So, Sir Humphrey Bumford and Tufton. And that these working class kids from Liverpool and Kent are becoming the new aristocrats.
And having a lovely time.
Having a lovely time as well. They want to drag them down, don't they? Yeah, I think there's a lot of that in it. So, nothing's ever been proven whether he planted stuff or not. But there's all this kind of stuff. You're right. Lennon and him stayed in touch. They wrote to each other. There are Christmas cards. In I Am the Walrus... He is the Semolina Pilchard, Norman Pilchard. So he actually says in an interview, I am the walrus. But I don't think anyone's ever suggested that he was actually the walrus. But he definitely is the Semolina Pilchard in that.
Lennon sends him a postcard from Japan saying, you can't catch me now.
That's right, which is hilarious, isn't it? There's a 2003 Primus song, Pilcher's Squad, which is about him. If you've seen the Monty Python sketch, in the Piranha Brothers sketch, they're terrified of a character called Spiny Norman. That's supposed to be based on Norman Pilcher. In another sketch, Graham Chapman, as a character very like him, says, I'm charging you with illegal possession of whatever we happen to have down there at the station. And Eric Idle, in the Ruttles pastiche of 1978, which is brilliant, there's a policeman in there called Brian Plant, who's widely regarded to be based on Norman Pilcher. But in later years, he became completely, not pro-drugs, I wouldn't go that far, but he said that it was a mistake.
Yeah, pro-legalisation.
Completely said the war on drugs was a mistake. Yeah. And it's quite
sweet.
He
took it all underground and led to kind of gang warfare and all that sort of stuff.
That's right, and he also said quite sweetly, all these people wanted to do, I now realise, was have a nice time, but I was only doing my job.
Yeah,
I think he was enjoying it a bit as well.
What's also interesting, he actually had he sort of, I mean, I don't know if enjoyed is the right word, but he was okay in prison for that. So he played football, didn't he, and cricket for the prison team.
He did.
And then it was only later that he said he'd become angry. I mean, we're talking like 40 years later or something.
Yeah, I know,
really,
I know.
Like, delayed anger.
Those two albums you're talking about, they signed, including Two Virgins, they went for auction in the 1990s, but I'm afraid we don't know exactly how much they went for or who they went to.
So if that was you that bought it.
If it was you, tell us. In 2020, if you want to know more, he brought out an autobiography called Bent Coppers, which he talks about all his celebrity deals with drug stars. Drug stars? I think I'll say that again. With pop stars? They're very much not drug stars, shall I say. But he passed away March 14th this year after a long battle with cancer. But yeah.
What an interesting life.
And there's one bit of YouTube footage of him taking, not Brian Jones himself, who I think is waiting in the back of the car, frightened, but taking another member of the counterculture to the back of the car. But yeah, so Wendy Carlos and Norman Pilcher.
Norman Pilcher.
Never let it be said that we're not eclectic.
So yeah, join us next week if you can.
If you can.
At Timber Festival, or you can just listen online as normal.
If you're down there at Timber Festival, come along. Otherwise, depending which order you're listening to these in, because that's the way of podcasts, isn't it? You could be listening to this in the year 2044, in which case, how are those hover jetpacks and protein pill food going? But we got one more in this season of Notable, and we think it might be the history of the music festival and the Voyager Golden Record.
Indeed. Join us then.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Notable, the podcast.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.